commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it was another fun week in technology. This, of course, was we had Ada Lovelace Day this week. on October 16th.
I always laugh because that's a bit I use a lot in our best of shows because it was so
right.
much fun
and
the
so
first time.
Ada mm-hmm. Lovelace was we were celebrating all of her, and I'll give a little bit of history about Ada later in the show.
Yes.
We also there was a study that looked at hackers' zero-day exploits, and they have a shelf life of around 10 months. And a zero-day exploit goes on the open market for around $250,000. So it's kind of an interesting study, and I'll go through that, what it is, these are, and you know where they're used. We'll talk something about the top technology job trends, and where the most action is, and which metropolitan areas have the most action. We'll provide that, and I'm also going to feature Robert. Ovechinsky, he was actually an American scientist. He came up with a lot of technology like rewritable CDs. He invented the battery that's used in your laptop. Very prolific inventor, and he never went to college.
Wow.
He died this week. That's why I'm featuring him, and he's got quite an interesting life. And, of course, it was a huge mailbag. Let me lift that up. It's huge.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Yeah, we got an email from Hawk in Bowie.
I gave you a little help there.
Thank you. I needed help. That was really so big. Got an email from Hawk in Bowie. Hawk's one of our regular listeners.
She's prolific, is she not?
Oh, yeah. Dear Dr. Schertz, I recently bought an iPad and would like to view the pictures I've taken over the past several months on my iPhone. On my iPad. I want to look at them both. I want to synchronize my iPhone and my iPad.
That should be simple, right?
Yeah, it is simple. How can I copy the pictures from my iPhone to my iPad? My husband and I are faithful Tech Talk Radio listeners. Oh, I love to hear that.
That's great.
Yeah. We've enjoyed fine dining at both your Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge locations as quiz winners four times over the past several years.
They might have to claim you on their tax form now.
That's right. It could be. I wonder if that's a taxable income.
Probably.
Yeah, we won't turn you in.
Nobody's paying attention.
That's right. Bowie. I've gone to a restaurant in Bowie. I think I've had clams there a few times. I can't remember the name of it, but it's fantastic.
In Bowie?
Yeah, in Bowie.
Huh.
I'm trying to remember the name of the restaurant, but it had excellent clams. Well, thanks for listening, Hawk, and for your loyalty to Tech Talk Radio. Now, Apple recently changed the photo streaming feature. This is why you're having trouble synchronizing. In the first case, when they first brought out photo streaming, this was where you could automatically share photos. People didn't really like it. First of all the photos were automatically streamed that you took, and you might take a bad picture. It's immediately streamed there to the iCloud, and then you couldn't delete it. So people were complaining, how can I delete my photo stream? You know, they went to, say, they go to Las Vegas, and then bingo. There might be a picture they want to delete, and they can't delete it. And so the only way to get rid of it was
something in Vegas might be something.
That's right.
Delete.
And so then what they actually did, they changed it so you could delete photos, and they completely changed the whole photo stream method. So let me explain. And now what they do, I'm using it. By the way, I did a photo stream I shared with you. You might.
You know what's funny? While you were talking about this, I am attempting to join up.
Yeah, the photo stream right there. You don't have to join it. I sent it right to your iPhone.
My iPhone.
Yeah, I'm streaming right to your iPhone. I've invited you to photo stream on the iPhone.
Oh, I was looking at it on my email, on my Gmail.
No, it goes right there. You click on there, and you can actually, I set up a photo stream I shared with you this morning, so you could experience it firsthand. Okay, this is what
How'd
you do.
How'd you get into my iPhone?
Are the pictures, are the Tech Talk pictures in your iPhone?
No, I'm looking.
Yeah, they're there. I've been hacking you. I'm looking at. No, I didn't hack your iPhone, Jim. You know, relax.
Yeah, it's a little
okay.
early for this.
Okay, right. this is how you implement PhotoStream now, Hawk. This is a good question. Let me get to it. First of all, you want to open up the Photos app. That's the native Photos app.
I'm doing this now. Okay.
Yeah, and then open up the Photos app. Now down at the bottom there should be streaming. You had to accept it.
Nothing on my phone.
You had to accept an email from me.
Yeah, let me do that on my phone here then.
Yeah, you have to accept my email.
You keep talking, and I'm gonna open up my email.
I sent you an email. You have to open it up on the phone.
I see it on the. Oh, you have to give me step by step.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have to open it up on the phone, Jim.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what you do is you open up the native Photos app on the. In case since I sent it to you, you just open up that email. Now, once you've opened up the Photos app, on the bottom there are tabs. You click on the. On the photo stream tab, that's the middle tab on the bottom, and that brings up your photo stream screen. Then you click the plus button on the top. This is used to create a new photo stream. Now, what you have to do is you've got to put an email address of who you want to share it with. Now, if you want to share it with just yourself so it shows up on your iPad, you put in your own email address. That would be the email address that you actually, say, use for iTunes. But if you want to share it with somebody else, you can put in as many people as you want to share that photo stream with. Then you hit Create. You press the Create button. And that creates the photo stream and shares it with whatever email addresses you've got. Now you go back and click on the left tab on the bottom. And that is actually then the pictures tab. And then you go to one of the picture albums and you open up that picture album and then you click edit on the picture album. And then you go through all the pictures and you tap on the picture and a check mark shows up. And then you select the pictures you want to share with the check mark. And then down in the bottom there's a share button. You hit share. And then you say, I want to share it with a photo stream and pick the photo stream. And once it's done, bingo, all those pictures show up in the photo stream and it's shared with everybody real time. Now, this you can only share photo stream with other iPhone users, but this is great. Like if you're on a vacation, you've got four or five people with all an iPhone, you can set up a photo stream and every time you take a picture, you can share it to the photo stream and share it with everyone else. This feature is fantastic. I've been using it for the last couple of weeks, and thank you for asking the question because I actually wasn't using PhotoStream until I got the question. But because of this question, I now have it.
Perfect.
Did you get them on your iPhone yet?
It's telling me my Apple ID password has expired. So this is something I'm going to deal with after the show.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand that because I used it last week. I'm not sure what that means.
Your Apple ID is expired.
Yeah.
Well, it's there, Jim, if you ever solve your little local problems.
I will figure it out.
I really can't do everything.
I know. Wow. What a dig.
We got an email from Margaret in Bethesda. Mm. Dear Doc, I listen every Saturday a.m. and look forward to your show, Classroom of the Airways. Boy, she's got that. Yeah, I have a Windows 7 operating system laptop and use Windows Live Media to get my mail. I'm going to need to burn or save all my Windows Live Media mail stuff onto a CD and move it to another laptop that runs XP. Will this work? What's the quickest way to do it? I use Roxio normally to burn stuff onto my CD. Thanks much. The best, Margaret in Bethesda. Well, if you need to switch hardware or reinstall Windows Live Media, it's a good idea to first export everything, to an external subdirectory, then basically transport that subdirectory to another computer and then re-import it into Windows Live Mail. That's commonly known as backup and restore. Now, if you've added Windows email accounts to Windows Live Mail, say like Gmail or Yahoo, most of these accounts just basically allow you to read the messages in Windows Live Mail, and you don't delete them on the main account. So you can simply add them on the new computer as accounts, and they'll automatically sync up. You don't have to do anything. On the other end, if you've got a POP3 account, that's Post Office Protocol, POP, P-O-P, you want to check on the Advanced tab to see if the messages are removed from the POP3 server. Now, if you have not removed the messages from the POP3 server, you can simply go to the other Windows Live Media client, and you can add that POP account on there, and all your emails will come down. On the other hand, if you have deleted the emails from the POP3 server and they only reside in your Windows Live account, then you've got to back them up. Now, your Windows Live calendar, you don't have to transfer that because you can simply go to calendar.live.com, put in your username and password, and it will automatically sync up. So you only actually have to worry about transferring contacts and any mail that's been deleted from the main server. So what you want to do to export messages from Windows Live Mail, simply open up Windows Live Mail. In the upper left-hand corner, open the File menu and click Export Email. And then you just select the target folder where you want to hit, and then you hit Finish, and it exports it all the mail to that target folder. To export your contacts, you open up Windows Live Mail. In the upper left-hand corner, select Contacts, click Export on the ribbon, and then select the file format in the drop-down menu. Now, I would select the CSV format because that allows you to transport all of the contacts individually. You don't want to do the other format because that means you got to transfer every contact separately, import them separately. You want to do them as a CSV file. Then you click Browse, select your target subdirectory where you're going to save them, and then you save them. Then you simply... Once you've got that subdirectory set up, you can transport that to the new computer. I'd use a thumb drive, actually. I wouldn't burn a CD. You could burn it on a CD. Or you could simply hook both computers to your Wi-Fi network and do file sharing and copy it over the network. You don't necessarily have to use Roxio to do the CD, but you could. Then once you take that subdirectory, take it to your new computer, then you simply import it. And, you know, it's just the reverse. To import the email message into Windows Live Mail, you open Windows Live Mail and then open the file menu in the upper left-hand corner and then click Import. You select the file format. In this case, you have exported into Windows Live Mail format, so you're going to import Windows Live Mail. Click Next. Select Transfer, and then click Finish, and they're all in there. And you can import contacts the same way. Open up Windows Live Mail, select Contacts, click Import on the ribbon, and select the format, which, of course, I said was CSV, and then you select the transfer folder and then click Next, and they're all imported in. So that's actually a very simple thing to do. Windows Live Mail is actually, it just consolidates all these other email accounts. So I always leave the emails on the main server, so if I move Windows Live Mail to another machine, I don't have to do any of this import-export stuff. I just simply can synchronize with those servers, and I get all the mail set up directly. But that was a great question, Margaret. Sorry, it was a little bit complicated, but I thought I'd give you the specific step-by-step details.
And you can get... If you missed the step, you can get it online later on.
That's right. We're going to post this entire discussion online, and the step-by-step discussion is right online. Simply go to techtalkonline.com, and we'll get the show outline posted, and you can review it to your heart's content. Or you can listen to the show again as a podcast. Now, we got an email from Robert Tyler. Dear Dr. Schertz, I have a candidate for your Profiles in IT segment of your show. His name is Donald Knuth. K-N-U-T-H. He's been called the father of the analysis of algorithms and has made a lot of contributions to computer science over the years. Your show has given me hours of entertainment, education, and knowledge during these many years I've been listening via your podcast.
Hours.
Yeah. I think it should be months.
I was going to say,
years.
Because you could, as we've done before, you could do an entire week of Tech Talk Vacation.
You certainly could. You could have a whole thing. And thank you for making these available to everyone, Robert Tyler. Well, Robert, Donald Knuth is a good suggestion. I put him in the hopper of a Profile in IT people. By the way, if you're trying to check if we've already featured a person on Tech Talk, you can search the RSS feed on the Stratford website. It's stratford.edu/rss/techtalkradio.xml. I mean, if you go to the if you go to techtalkonline.com and do the feed discovery, you'll find it. And you can simply put in the name and search. And as it turns out, Donald Knuth, I have not covered on Tech Talk, so that was a good suggestion. We got an email from Alex in Atlanta. Dear Doc, I'm an audiophile, and I've been recording my music collection using FLAC, a lossless file compression format, which is superior to MP3. Now I want to buy a portable FLAC player. What do you recommend? So do you record yours in MP3 or FLAC, Jim?
I do MP3. I've heard about FLAC before, but it takes up a whole lot more space, doesn't it?
No, not really. FLAC stands for free. There is a lossless Apple format that takes more space. And there's also a Windows Media lossless that takes more space. But FLAC actually does pretty darn good compression. It doesn't take that much more space. FLAC stands for free lossless audio codec. It's an audio format similar to MP3, but lossless, meaning that the audio is compressed in FLAC without any loss in quality. See, MP3s actually make certain compromises, and they don't record everything perfectly. It's a lossy compression. Now, this is similar to how ZIP works, except with FLAC, you get much better compression because it's designed specifically for audio. And you can play back compressed FLAC files on your favorite players that support FLAC, just like you'd an MP3 file. Now, FLAC stands out as the fastest and most widely supported lossless audio codec, and the only one that is non-proprietary. It's open source. That's why I love it so much. Mm. It's unencumbered by patents and has open source reference implementation. It is well documented format, and there are several other independent implementations of this that are available. Now, CNET did an analysis of top portable players, the MP3 players, that also will play FLAC. They've got the Samsung Galaxy Player 4.2, and that basically is kind of a direct competitor with the Apple iPod Touch Media Player, and it's an excellent option. The street price for the Samsung Galaxy Player 4.2, it plays MP3 as well as FLAC, is $179. But now, here is the editor's choice on that CNET article, the SanDisk Sansa Clip Zisk. Now, the SanDisk MP3 player is a great practical clip-on. It's perfect for the gym. Get this, a street price of $53.
That's not bad at all.
Not bad at all, and that's why it was selected as a CNET editor's choice. It plays both MP3 as well as FLAC. Now, there are a lot of other, very, very more expensive component type of players that will play FLAC, but you were interested in the portable ones.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from a loyal listener.
There's no way to get a FLAC file onto your iPod, is there?
As I was reading this, I was wondering if I could put it on my iPad. I'm thinking that they don't support FLAC.
I would guess
not. Because it's open source,
yeah.
But you know. That's a guess.
I'm gonna do
some research later in the show.
If there's a way to do it, you'd find out.
I'll do,
because you're an audiophile too.
I'm a little bit of an audiophile. Mm-hmm. Yes. We got an email from a loyal listener. Dear Dr. Schertz, I'm hoping you would share with your listener some of your top five applications for your iPhone or smartphone. I'm not remembering which you have. I just bought an iPhone 5.
Well, you know what I have because you hacked into my phone, right?
Oh, yeah. You've got the iPhone 3.
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah. You got the 5.
I got a 4.
Oh, you got the 4. You got the 4S. Oh, yeah.
Look at that.
Oh, you got the 4S. I forgot. So you've got the same one as I have.
Exactly. So you and I are on the same plane here.
I'm going to have to get an iPhone 5. This is just being at your level is really very uncomfortable for me.
What happens when I get an iPad? What happens?
Oh, that'll be a big problem. If you get an iPad 3, I'm going to have to send Marianne to another conference.
I was going to say, I was hoping maybe Marianne would win one for me this time.
Well, what I'm interested in is a good app that tells real-time traffic status in the D.C. metro area and there's a website where you can get some apps. Well, let me give you a kind of a rundown on a few of the apps I like, and then I'll have this full list on the Tech Talk Radio show. I like Camera Plus because it's got very convenient image processing, so I can use Camera Plus instead of the native camera, and then I can tweak it with image processing. People say, "Wow, look at the colors you got!" I say, "Well, you know, I've got just an eye for colors, but it's really the magic of Camera Plus."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I like Flashlight. Because when I'm going in a dark area at night, I can turn on flashlight and I can use the flash as a flashlight. And I tell you, the iPhone makes a pretty good flashlight if you're trying to find your keys at night.
Yeah.
I use Flipboard for all my Tech Talk research. Flipboard, and I simply put in all of the different keywords and the kind of topics that I want to come up. And Flipboard makes it like a little magazine for me of all of the topics that are of use for Tech Talk.
So you put Tech Talk together on your phone?
Yeah.
Really?
I do research all week during the week on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll find articles on Flipboard, and then I forward them to my Gmail account.
Ah,
so they're all there ready to go. So I can do research on Tech Talk anywhere.
I never thought that's his, but the iPhone has changed so many things, hasn't it?
It really has. It really
more
has.
More so than any other phone, don't you think?
Yeah, it has. It's a different way of working with everything. and it did really change the whole world of the smartphone. I use MapQuest. MapQuest for driving instructions. It has turn-by-turn driving instructions, which are really quite good. I mean, as you know, the native turn-by-turn instructions with the new Apple phone are garbage.
Yeah.
And you'll get lost, and you might end up, you know, who knows where. So MapQuest is pretty good. Now, there is a crowdsourced driving deal called Waze, W-A-Z-E, and it allows people to update real-time traffic. Now, MapQuest actually has traffic information in it. It's an AOL service, and it's free. Waze is crowdsourced, and so I've got a couple of friends that use Waze, W-A-Z-E, for their turn-by-turn driving instructions, and then there's real-time update, and you can see all the different Waze people in the area. And what you can do, like, you'll see another Waze user on a particular intersection. You click on them, you can send a message, you say, hey, how's the traffic there? And you can get direct feedback, and you know where actually are.
Used Waze. Waze is pretty cool. The only problem I've got with Waze is some of the stuff they give you is pretty vague about the location. Sometimes they just give you a street, but they don't give you a cross location, and that's a little bit...
It's not. I mean, some of the crowdsourced data is a little bit loose.
Now, a good way to put it, yes.
I do like TED, T-E-D. This is a technology entertainment. It's for inspirational talks about the future, so I get a lot of, like, inspirational ideas from TED. I really do enjoy that. Paper Karma.
In that case, I'm going to have to shop for you at Successories for your Christmas
present. Yeah.
Okay. Shirts with inspirational stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So, TED, I mean, there's some great talks on TED, and sometimes I'll get an idea for profiles in IT from TED. Now, I use Paper Karma. You got all this junk mail that comes to the house.
Yeah.
With Paper Karma, I take a picture of the junk mail and I upload it, and they put me on the Do Not Mail list.
Really?
So the amount of junk mail coming into my house has dropped dramatically.
No kidding. Wow.
And... Okay, now, see, Marianne's out of the country, so I can say this. All of these sale things, like to Macy's, Nordstrom's, and all these things that she just waits for,
God.
I'm on the Do Not Mail list, so I get no sales.
And she'll never...
she doesn't know because they're just not coming to the house. So I can say that because she's in Ireland. So I love Paper Karma. I've done Paper Karma, probably done 80 or 90, requests for Do Not Mail.
I've got a value pack envelope at home that's going to be taken a picture of later on.
Now, I'll tell you, I love the Amazon application.
Mm-hmm.
The Amazon application is so if I want to order something, I can go to the Amazon app and I can order it in like 2-3 minutes. It's just so convenient. Now, I do like the Find iPhone application, because it allows me to ring an iPhone that the buzzer's been turned off.
Uh-huh.
So Marianne loses her iPhone in the house, and I can actually I can make it ring, and it will continue ringing until she picks it up, even though the ringer's turned off.
Really?
And then if somebody steals your iPhone, you can track where it is.
Let me ask you this. Does it have to be on the phone that you're trying to track, or just on the phone that you're trying to dial the phone from?
You have to enable GPS tracking on the phone.
Okay.
So I went in, I enabled GPS tracking
on her phone. Okay.
And so now, Find iPhone is mine, not on hers. I can also go to the iCloud and find iPhone on the iCloud if I just use a PC, and her phone will ring.
Somebody's watching.
That's right, so you can always tell that. I tell you, when I'm traveling internationally, I use Google Translate. If I've got a Wi-Fi connection, I can put in an English phrase, and it will translate it to the local language, and I can just simply hold up the iPhone, and they can read it. And that's really convenient when you're trying to...
Why, we've used that on the air before, have we not?
We haven't used Google Translate. Maybe we have used Google Translate.
I use her to speak English.
Now, the trouble was, when I used this Google Translate in Vietnam, I was in South Vietnam, and it was the Hanoi dialect.
Ah.
So it was irritating some of the folks in Hue, because I was holding these messages up with the Hanoi dialect, and so but they liked the fact that I took the effort. Now, I love voice over IP calling with my iPhone. I've got Skype and Viber. Viber is great. I use Viber a lot. It's a voice over IP client for the phone. It's all free. Now, of course, I got LinkedIn for Business. Bump is fun. B-U-M-P. Bump. Have you ever somebody says, hey, what's that contact? If both of the phones have bump, I can say, I'm going to share this contact. I can bump the two phones together, and it transfers the contact. Or suppose I want to share some pictures with somebody. I can open up bump. I can select the pictures I want to share. I can bump the phone with the other phone, and the pictures automatically transfer. So that's kind of a fun application. And, of course, my favorite streaming application is Pandora. I can pick out Pandora allows me to pick out artists that I want to stream, and they'll create a dedicated radio station just for me based on the kind of music that that artist particularly does. Yelp for restaurant reviews I really enjoy. So I can go out there, and I can be driving, and there'll be a lot of restaurants in the area. I can just click Yelp, and I say, give me, you know, find all the restaurants in the area, and it will list all the reviews. So now what I'm doing, I'm reading the reviews before I go to the restaurant. And the Yelp reviews are actually pretty good. When I travel internationally, I like to use Wikihood. You know, this is actually what it does. It takes all the Wikipedia. It takes all the Wikipedia articles that are for things that are located in your area. So it gives you a list of all the Wikipedia features in your area, and so you can actually decide what to look at. Now, for airline reservations, the application I like the best is HipMonk. HipMonk. And I'll tell you, the HipMonk, you know, a lot of times you've got layovers. It gives sort of a graphical layout of the layovers, and so you can actually pick the best option very quickly, and it's got a great user interface. I love HipMonk. Now, for synchronizing files, you know, I put a file on my iPad, put a file on my computer. I use Dropbox.
That's great, isn't it?
So Dropbox, it's a folder. It's Dropbox folder on my. And so if I can copy a file to the Dropbox folder on my PC, it shows up on my iPhone and my iPad automatically. Because of course, the iPhone and the iPad don't have thumb drives. They don't have USB ports, so you've got to synchronize with subdirectories. And finally, for productivity. Because I don't play all the time. Sometimes I try to actually be productive on my on my devices.
No kidding.
What I use for Microsoft Office equivalent are the Apple products, Pages, which is their version of Excel, Pages, which is their version of Word, Numbers, which is their version of Excel, and Keynote, which is their version of PowerPoint. So I've got Pages, Numbers, and Keynote, and that's what I use if I have to read any Microsoft Office files. I'll tell you, I am waiting for Microsoft Office to release a version of Microsoft Office for the iPad.
That'd be great.
And it's coming out soon.
Oh, we have a comment for you since you finished. Were you finished with that particular?
I'm finished with
that
segment.
Okay, we have a comment for you.
Okay.
We have used Google Translate on this show before. I am sorry you have forgotten about me, Dr. Schertz.
Okay, I'm so sorry. Okay.
You don't remember her?
No, I'd remember her. No. Okay, come over here, you know. I'll give you a hug. Okay. Oh, we got an email from another regular listener. This is our last email from a regular listener.
Probably a good thing.
Yeah, an email from Tung in Ohio. She said, you know, we got a whole listening group in Ohio.
We do.
It's actually amazing.
I wonder if they get together in the morning and just sit down.
I think they're all up there listening to Tech. They're all gathering around the around the computer listening to Tech Talk now with the live stream. Dear Doc. Oh, this is getting more informal now that they've sent several emails.
Yeah.
I'm confused about CDs that play music. Is there a special format for a music CD? Love the show. Listen to your podcast here in Ohio. Thanks, Tung. Well, Tung, audio CDs use a completely different format than data CDs or DVDs that you might use on your computer. As a result, they require a different approach to create. A data CD is very much like a hard drive. It contains sectors and files and folders and all the things that we're used to seeing on a hard disk. In fact, the CD is written very much like a concentric set of data circles, just as hard disks are. Now, an audio CD is more similar to a vinyl record. It's best thought of as a single spiral of data, sort of the reverse of that of vinyl. It starts in the middle and slowly spirals outward as a single stream of bits. While a data CD can contain music, it's often in the form of compressed MP3s or files or in other audio formats like FLAC that we just learned about. The result can be several hours of music in roughly 700 megabytes of data that you can store on a CD. Now, that's not true for an audio CD. A single spiral of data can contain only one format, uncompressed. So it's uncompressed, so the audio CDs actually contain less data. Typically, you've got 16-bit stereo at a sampling rate of 14 kilohertz. Now, if you do the math, 16 bits per sample, two stereo tracks times 45 samples per second divided by 8 bits per byte, you find that an audio CD requires 176,000 bytes per second of audio, and that a 700 megabyte CD can only hold 69 minutes of audio. So obviously, if you want to get more audio on the CD, you're better off using either MP3 or FLAC. And of course, there are audio CD players that can also play data CDs. Mm-hmm. These normally have the MP3 logo on them, and that's where the confusion comes from. Great question. I'm glad you noticed there was a difference between a data CD and an audio CD. And I'll tell you, I love all of our listeners in from Ohio, and thanks for that email, Tony.
Well, now, if our listeners want to send you an email or any kind, well, it will be my email. How will we get to you?
Do you want to, we get all of our emails through techtalk@stratford.edu. That's how we get them, and those are forwarded directly to me, and I'll pick them up on the show. And we love all these emails because they're an important part of the show.
Now, and of course, you're a multitasker, so while you're doing all of this, there's something else you're doing over there.
Oh, yes. I'm also monitoring our Facebook page. You go to facebook.com/techtalkonline, and I'll monitor your comments live during the show.
This is your classroom of the airwaves, heard every week at 9 o'clock Eastern on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, and 1035 FM HD2.
You are listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio. Please stand by. We will be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Robots in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Stanford Robert Obshinsky. You're familiar with Stanford Robert Obshinsky.
I'm sure I'm about to know everything I ever wanted to know about him.
And the one thing you will know, he did not go to Stanford. Okay. Stanford Robert Obshinsky is an American inventor and scientist whose inventions include, listen to this list, batteries that we use in laptops and computers
Pretty
and digital
amazing.
Cameras, thin film solar energy panels, flat-screen LCDs, rewritable CD and DVD discs, hydrogen fuel cells, and non-volatile phase-change memory. He accomplished all of this without a college degree and has been compared to Edison.
Wow.
Stanford Robert Obshinsky was born November 24, 1922, in Akron, Ohio. Before graduating from high school in June 1941, Obshinsky worked as a toolmaker. During World War II, he worked in the tool room of a Goodyear plant in Arizona. Near the end of the war, he returned to Akron and started his own machine company, initially in a barn. He developed and patented his first invention, the Benjamin Center Drive, named after his father. I guess his father's name was Benjamin. This or unique center. Automatic high-speed drive lathe had many important uses, including the production of artillery shells during the Korean War. Ovshinsky developed an interest in human and machine intelligence. So he began studying the research literature on neurophysiology, neurological diseases, and cybernetics. He was kind of interested in that, and that actually fueled a lot of his later research. In 1951, Ovshinsky accepted an offer to move to Detroit and work
How unfortunate.
And work in the automotive industry as director of research for Hupp Motor Company.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard of Hupp Motor Company.
Nor have I.
Yeah. He invented the electric power steering.
Huh.
Which was actually, you know, ahead of its time.
Oh, wait a minute. I have heard of Hupp. They made the Hupp Mobile, if I'm not mistaken. I'm serious. I'm going to check. Yeah, I will.
But the Hupp's president, who was not really a visionary, was opposed to completing any kind of arrangements with General Motors to utilize the product. So that electric variation of the that electric power steering really didn't make much progress because it was stopped from the top. Then Stan and Herb Ovshinsky, Herb's his brother, started their second company, called General Automation. I guess he was so distraught over Hupp's rejection of his electric power steering. Mm-hmm. They started a second company called General Automation in the Detroit storefront. Now, that's when he continued his study of the use of, intelligent, use of computers and machines to look at neurophysiology. He began actually studying intelligent machines. He embarked on early research and development of various energy and information technologies. By the late 1950s, Stan had invented and Herb Ovshinsky had built an artificial nerve cell using amorphous thin films, which were using an amorphous thin film switch that they called the Ovatron. See, this was a very innovative idea using amorphous silicon instead of single crystal silicon, or amorphous materials instead of single crystal materials. Everybody's working on single crystal materials back then for transistors, and he created this whole new field on amorphous semiconductors. Stan patented the device, and the brothers disclosed it publicly in 1959 in New York City. Ovshinsky opened the scientific field of amorphous and disordered materials in the course of his research in the 40s and 50s. In 1960, Ovshinsky and his second wife, Iris Dibner, founded Energy Conversion Laboratory, dedicating the laboratory to the solution of important societal problems. Amorphous silicon became the basis of many technologies, including writable CDs and DVDs, solar energy, because they were actually rolling out amorphous solar cells out of machines that are they're miles long, the LCD flat panel display, and electronic memory. His wife, by the way, had a Ph.D.
Mm-hmm.
After his wife's death, he started a new company, Ovshinsky Innovation, which was devoted to innovative and revolutionary energy and information electronics. On October of 2007, he married Rosa Young. At that point, he was 84 years old.
He's a smart guy, right?
Yeah, he married Rosa Young. She was a physicist who worked on the hydrogen-powered hybrid car at ECD, and she shared his vision of a hydrogen economy. Ovshinsky was self-taught. This is without any formal college or graduate training. Many well-known scientists visited his labs, including John Bardeen, co-inventor of the transistor. He actually had a cadre of very great scientists that worked with him kind of in a advisory capacity, and they loved the way he thought. Kind of the key to his innovation is that he brought together a lot of different fields that normally didn't talk. See, one of the problems with traditional research, people get in a particular discipline, it's a silo. There could be another silo over here, and the people in the two silos don't actually cross-pollinate very much in ideas and concepts. But because he wasn't any kind of formal education, he was looking in multiple silos all across the board, and he was able to innovate in quite a dramatic way. Because of his many inventions in digital memory, solar energy, battery technology, optical media, solid-state hydrogen power storage, and his hundreds of scientific patents, he's often been compared to Thomas Edison. In the area of alternative fuels, his pioneering work has caused in both solar cells as well as hydrogen cells. They have, many writers have referred to him as the modern world's most important energy visionary. I featured him because Obshinsky died of prostate cancer this week, October 17th, 2012, at age 89. A true innovator and a man who made a real difference trying to solve the big problems of the world just through the sheer creativity that he had. We don't have many scientists like that anymore.
What a remarkable life.
It's a remarkable life. Stanford Robert Obshinsky, inventor extraordinaire.
Hope you're paying attention, because in just a few moments you're going to have a chance to win valuable food based on the information culled from Profiles in IT. So pay attention, get ready, and get your dialing finger ready.
This is your classroom of the airwaves. Tech Talk Radio, heard weekly on
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas, and WTOP FM HD2 Washington. We'll be right back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Russ. This is Tech Talk Radio. If you were doing your job as a listening audience, you were just paying very strict attention to Profiles in IT, where Dr. Schertz talked about Stanford Robert Obshinsky, inventor extraordinaire, who came up with this little thing that we all have today in our cars called electric power steering. Well, the company that he worked for back then laughed at it, thought it was a dumb idea, and it didn't happen. What we need you to do is tell us what company he was working for when he invented electric power steering. If you have the correct answer to that question, you need to call us right now. And the way to do that is to dial these following 10 digits in the correct order. From east of Detroit, Michigan, it's 877-936-9333. From west of the Lettuce Belt, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Professor Andrew Mitchell, our adjunct professor for prize support and distribution, will be taking your calls. First person in with the correct answer wins tickets for fine dining, two free tickets to the Escoffier at Stratford University, fine dining on the campus in Falls Church, or at our campus in Woodbridge at the Cafe Kareem. This is Tech Talk Radio.
Where do most people destroy their iPhone?
Bathroom.
Yeah, let's look at the data. Now, actually, over the years, myself, I had one that was destroyed when Marianne washed my bathrobe, and it had the.
I don't want to think about you in a bathrobe.
It had the. Well, that's how I prepare Tech Talk every.
I'm leaving now.
But And then the second one that I destroyed, I had it in the pocket of my swimming suit, and I went swimming in the
ocean. I don't
want to
think about that either. You tucked into the waistband of your Speedo.
I've only destroyed two, but I've never destroyed an iPhone, but I've destroyed two BlackBerries.
Really?
But now I'm now an iPhone devotee.
I usually wreck them by dropping them, but I had a StarTAC, which was my previous favorite phone before the iPhone. I ran that through the washing machine.
That'll do it every time.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, now according to a device warranty provider, SquareTrade, most people, that would be 21%, that is, damaged their phone in the kitchen. The runner-up is 18%. Ruin it in the living room, and only 16% ruin it in the bathroom. I'd have thought the bathroom would be number one.
I would have thought so, too.
All in all, 51% of iPhone accidents happen inside the house. Now, to find out, the company tapped the survey sampling and asked 35 questions to 2,000 iPhone owners in August. Other findings include that water is overwhelmingly the most common liquid.
And that's the one thing that they won't replace
that's
it for, right?
They actually have a little tag inside the phone. They can tell if it's been damaged by water.
No kidding.
Yeah, it turns red.
Wow.
I tried to go to Verizon and say, my BlackBerry I need it replaced under warranty because it's not working. So they took off the back cover.
And
they took out the battery, and there was this red dot. They said, I'm sorry, sir. This BlackBerry's been wet.
Mm-hmm.
You've been busted.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get it replaced under warranty. Okay, 43% of the time is damaged by water. 19% of the time is damaged by soda. 12% of the time is damaged by beer or coffee.
Will they replace it if it's damaged by another liquid besides water?
You know, I'll have to check the details on that.
And I wonder if the little sensor thingy turns red for other liquids.
I'm certain it does.
You've got to figure that out for us.
Okay, now the results follow a similar study published by SquareTrade last month that claimed Americans alone have spent $5.9 billion on damaged iPhones. Now, the same survey noted that the main reason phones became damaged in the first place, the main reason was falling out of user hands. 30% of the time, followed by liquid damage, 18% of the time.
Beer will help it fall out of user hands.
Yeah, maybe that's you drink the beer and then you drop
exactly.
it. Maybe that's how that works.
Probably.
And you are listening to Tech Talk Radio, heard weekly on Federal News Radio, Saturday mornings at 9, on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. We'll be right back after this, maybe.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
A budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And, of course, August 16th was Ada Lovelace Day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ada Lovelace...
You mean October 16th.
Yeah, what did I say?
August.
Oh, yeah, October 16th. Yeah, it must be...
Whatever it takes.
It is October 16th.
It's one of the 16th. You got 12 chances to get it right.
Ada Lovelace was a pioneer. She was the daughter of Lord Byron. Ada was also the daughter of a woman who was fed up with Lord Byron. because he was a womanizer.
Ah.
If you get into the dirty little details of Lord Byron. Now, in an effort to dampen the dangerous poetic blood in her daughter that flowed from Lord Byron, she encouraged her to study mathematics and not study poetry at all. Despite this, Ada did enjoy poetry and mathematics, asking her mother in a letter if she wouldn't let her study some poetry. Maybe she could at least do some poetical science. Poetical science.
What is that?
It's just a combination of the two. Actually, science was poetic to Ada. While everyone else was likely bored to tears at a dinner party when old Babbage droned on about his analytical engine, Ada was fascinated. She liked it so much that she began corresponding with Babbage, even writing up notes on and summarizing Babbage's plans. In those notes, Ada predicted that the machine, like Babbage's, was planning would one day be used to compose music, produce graphics, and would be employed for practical and scientific use. Of course, like many so other great visionaries, she left us far too young, dying of an illness at only age 36. Now, we celebrate Ada not for her visions of computers, but because she suggested a plan for the engine to calculate Bernoulli numbers. And that algorithm is now considered to be the first computer program. So Ada Lovelace is... Is now,
is it 10 o'clock yet?
We're moving. She was considered to be the first computer programmer. In fact, there was an Ada programming language written after her. In honor of Lady Lovelace, we now have October 16th as Ada Lovelace Day. And so there we go.
I'm glad you told me about that.
That's right.
Okay.
Hackers exploit the zero-day bugs for up to 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
Software vendors are constantly on the watch for the so-called zero-day vulnerabilities. These are flaws in their code that hackers find and exploit before the first day, on the first day that the code is released. They're able to use these flaws for up to 10 months. This is one of the findings of a broad study of hacker zero-day exploits by two researchers at the antivirus firm Symantec. Lila Bilge and Tudor Dumitra used data collected from 11 million PCs running Symantec's antivirus software to correlate and catalog zero-day attacks. Using data analysis, they found that 18 attacks that represented zero-day exploits occurred between February 2008 and March of 2010, only 7 of which were previously known to have been exploited prior to their discovery. Most disturbingly, they found that these attacks continued 312 days on average, and sometimes up to 2.5 years before the security community became aware of them. 60% of the zero-day vulnerabilities that they identified in the study were not known before and suggests that there are many more zero-day exploits out there. One aspect of the zero-day exploits is that many of them are tough to track down and count because they infect not that many machines because the machines and the companies they're trying to target are so limited. All but 4 of the exploits infected less than 100 targets, and 4 were found to infect only one machine at all. A careful analysis of the zero-day exploits showed that many are reserved for stealthy espionage tactics rather than credit card harvesting. So this has now been moved into the realm of cyber warfare between countries. A lot of the attacks against the Iran nuclear plants use zero-day exploits that just targeted those particular ones. Now, people are actually selling zero-day exploits on the open market. A single zero-day exploit can cost as much as $250,000, and fees are often paid in installments based on the vulnerability remaining secret and unpatched. Unsurprisingly, the study showed that hackers target common software like Microsoft Word, Flash, and Adobe Reader. 16 of the 18 zero-day exploits analyzed affected only Microsoft and Adobe software. I really like snow. Well, you know, I haven't had a chance to do any snow skiing. Do you snow ski, Jim? Or
no, I'd break my neck if I snow skied. I'm not very coordinated.
Snow ski as opposed to the other kind of skiing?
Yeah, water skiing, as opposed to water skiing.
All right, yeah. I've snow skied in the past, yeah.
Yeah, I liked. I have not snow skied.
I wish I'd been there to see that.
I haven't done snow skiing for a few years, but I really do enjoy snow skiing. Get out in the wind in the mountains and just go like the breeze. It's wonderful. But the question is, with snowflakes, are two snowflakes ever alike? Now, there was a guy by the name of Wilson Snowflake Bentley who took over 6,000 photographs of individual snowflakes between the early 1880s and until his death in 1931. No two snowflakes were alike in his entire 50 years of research.
Well, at least he put his life to good use.
Now, snowflakes tend to have a six-sided geometry, and that comes from the hexagonal lattice structure of the ice molecule, which has six-sided symmetry. So most snowflakes have some sort of six-sided symmetry as they grow. But the fact is, it is true that no two snowflakes are alike. I should say, no two complex snowflakes are alike. If you have a very small snowflake, maybe just made up of 10 water molecules, it would be very simple. There might be some of those that are the same, but if you get a large complex snowflake, no two are alike. Now, here's how we can analyze it. First of all, you've got three variations that occur within snowflakes. You've got variations in isotopes that can be distributed throughout the snowflake, and I'll explain that a little bit further. You've got variations in stacking faults, and then you've got variations in growth dynamics. Now, it turns out that isotopes are like you can get atoms, stable atoms of a different weight, like, say, oxygen. Water is made up of oxygen, two oxygens and one oxygen and two hydrogen, H2O. And occasionally you'll get heavy water, deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen, and it's basically double the weight. It has an extra neutron in the nucleus, so it's atomic weight of 2 instead of 1, which is what hydrogen is. And those are distributed about one molecule out of every 5,000 molecules that actually is deuterium. So the deuterium molecules could be distributed randomly throughout the snowflake, you see, and there are a lot of ways that could be done. In addition, am I hearing music that's coming up?
I'm trying to play Winter Wonderland for you since you're talking about snowflakes.
Now, in addition, there's also an isotope of oxygen that occurs quite often. It has an atomic weight of 18 instead of the normal atomic weight of 16. So if you take all these variations, that you would have just in isotopes, it's unlikely that the isotope distribution for any two snowflakes would be the same. I mean, so just from an atomic level, they probably wouldn't be different, or they would be different. And so that's the first variation that you probably wouldn't see very often. Now, the second variation would be in stacking faults. When a crystal grows, the molecules don't stack together perfectly. You get stacking faults, they could be distributed. And you could argue that no two snowflakes could be alike because the stacking faults would be variable. And the third variation is that there are growth dynamics. As the snowflake is falling, it's encountering different dust particles, different air, encounters with the wind, and it grows in a slightly different way because each snowflake takes a different path. So if you take all of these three factors together, someone did a calculation, and they calculated that there are more variations on the way that a complex snowflake could grow than there are atoms in the universe.
Does temperature play any role in this? In addition, if it's very close to freezing or if it's really cold?
Yeah, temperatures if you got very colder temperatures, the ice crystal tips are sharper.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sharper looking, more attractive.
So those are the snowflakes that hurt when they hit you in the face.
Yeah, that's
right.
If they're big. I mean, now at warmer temperatures, the snowflakes grow slower, more rounder. They have less intricate shape. So temperature does make a difference. There have been, by the way, the largest snowflake that ever fell was in Siberia, and it was almost 8 inches in diameter.
Now that would hurt.
Now I've never seen that, but. But there you go. So that is the question.
That's more like a meteor than a snowflake,
yeah,
right?
Pretty much.
Okay,
nice meteor.
So Tech Talk can answer the question, every snowflake is unique.
That's it for this week. See you next week on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those